I'm Helen Avery at the Green Finance Institute, and you're listening to our COP15 special episode of Financing Nature with the United Nations Environment Programme. In this episode, I'll be talking with Elizabeth Marema, the Executive Secretary of the UN's Convention on Biological Diversity, the CBD, and David Ainsworth, Information Officer, also at the CBD. We'll be talking about the conference that starts today in Montreal.
The outcome we as the world community need is for a consensus to emerge on a strong set of goals for 2050, achievable targets for 2030.
Degrading biodiversity, it's not just an environmental issue. It spans economics, health, social justice, human rights. And as for your question, what's at stake? Well, future generations are at stake.
Welcome everyone to this special episode of Financing Nature for COP15 in partnership with the United Nations Environment Programme. As many of you will know, the conference starts today in Montreal, the conference that will see ministers from governments around the world come together to discuss how we can collectively halt the decline of biodiversity and agree, hopefully, on some targets. A bit of background on the CBD. It was signed by 150 government leaders back in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit and is dedicated to conserving biological diversity on the planet. It has now been ratified by 196 countries or parties. And it also now meets every 2 years to assess and agree targets. We have had a delay because of COVID. So that's why it's taking place this year and it has been split up, the meetings, which may actually work in favor of the ambitions, given it's really in the last 2 years that nature loss as a key concern has kind of risen in the ranks to be up there with climate change. So there's a lot of expectation for this particular conference. Can we get an agreement on the collective global vision for biodiversity, what's called the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework? And to discuss this, we are thrilled to be joined today by the CBD's Executive Secretary, Elizabeth Marema, and Information Officer, David Ainsworth. We're going to be talking about the hoped-for outcomes for COP15, including that framework and the targets, particularly in answering the question of how do we start to drive greater public funding and private finance into nature protection and restoration. And we'll be revisiting the question of what can financial institutions do now. So with all that, let's invite Elizabeth and David to join us. So welcome, Elizabeth and David. Thank you so much for joining us today in what must be an extremely busy period. How are you both?
I'm very fine. Thank you.
Doing well. Keeping active.
So we don't want to keep you any longer than we have to, given how much work you have ahead of you these next 2 weeks, not to mention all the work that has led up to this point. So maybe let's just dive right in with a bit of a refresh on COP27. We heard in our COP27 series about the risk of inaction when it comes to biodiversity and the need to mobilise finance for nature. So before we move on to this next 2 weeks at COP15, you were both at those COP27 meetings in Sharm el-Sheikh. We had some really big initiatives announced, funding for loss and damage. Do you feel we walked away from those meetings with some firmer commitments to nature? Are we moving into COP15, do you think, with some wind in the sails?
It's very encouraging and timely to see biodiversity taking center stage. And yes, the momentum will carry us well to our COP15. We did see a lot of interest and commitment at COP27. And if I may give just one example, the Enact initiative that was announced, it is a new initiative for nature-based solutions with the government of Germany and International Union on Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, which aims at enhancing the protection from and resilience to climate impacts of at least 1 billion vulnerable people. So this is just one example showing how biodiversity nature was on the agenda of the climate discussion. And even when we talk of loss on and damage, a fund which has been established, and you know here we are dealing of disasters, floods, droughts, these are equally nature related. So yes, good momentum moving forward to our conference of the parties about to begin.
So that's a really great reminder about ENACT with Germany and the IUCN, in addition to the global agreement on funding for loss and damage. What's your perspective, David, maybe beyond governments?
Well, I really think we're seeing a very high interest from business and financial organizations. There's a lot of them signing up to participate in the parallel events we'll be holding at COP15. And many of these businesses and financial organizations, they've got strong climate leadership, and they're really just starting to build their strategy on biodiversity now. We're aware that the representatives from the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, which was, and this also includes the co-chair of GFANZ, the Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, Mark Carney's project, they're also participating in parallel events at COP15 on finance. So I think what we're seeing is how strongly the topic of biodiversity is perceived by business leaders, along with the climate awareness that they have. And it's becoming an important pillar of their overall sustainability strategies.
Yeah, it does certainly seem that the private sector, the financial sector, is turning out in force to COP15 in Montreal. There are, of course, specific business and finance days also happening over the 2 weeks. But it also feels like the first biodiversity conference that has really drawn global attention, specifically from the private sector and the financial sector, which we'll come back to in a moment. But can you share with us, why is this one, COP15, so important? I always think it's worth reminding us all what's at stake.
This COP is critical because we are approaching the point of no return. We have seen from the recent scientific reports where, for instance, monitored wildlife population have seen a devastating 69% drop on average since 1970. We are being told 40% of the global population lacks access to clean and safe drinking water. We are seeing 75% of all emerging infectious diseases in humans are zoonotic in nature. And these zoonotic diseases are closely linked with the health of our ecosystem. Half of the global GDP is dependent on nature. Over $44 trillion of assets globally will be at risk from biodiversity loss. So there is significant biodiversity, also conservation funding gap, which is estimated at $700 billion per year from the Poulsson Institute report. And at the same time, investors feed trillions of dollars every year into activities that harm biodiversity. So there is a critical need to align financial flows to protect and restore biodiversity. And this is actually the vision of the new global biodiversity framework under negotiations.
The numbers that Elizabeth just shared, I mean, that's really the harsh reality. And that tells us why COP15 is really, really important. Not just to the parties who will be attending the meeting, but in fact, to the entire world. Looking at some of those figures, it shows that degrading biodiversity, it's not just an environmental issue. It spans economics, health, social justice, human rights. And as for your question, what's at stake? Well, future generations are at stake.
I mean, it really is alarming, isn't it? As you say, when we start to think about what is at stake for future generations. I always think when it comes to these statistics and figures, we should never get complacent about hearing them again and again. We really need that reminder that we're losing so much biodiversity, yet our global economy and our financial system are set up to just exacerbate that biodiversity loss at present. And so, David, just staying with you, talk us through what the key discussion will be at the conference.
The hope is that parties to the CBD will be finalizing this post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework, or I'll call it the GBF for short now that we've got it out of the way, I'll use acronyms. So the main goal of the GBF is to ensure that we are able to realize this 2050 vision we have under the convention. It's the shared vision of living in harmony with nature. What we've got right now in the original draft are four different goals. So first of all, The idea is that this framework is going to put in place the tools and solutions that we need to implement and mainstream biodiversity, including this important question of mobilizing financial flows.
Right.
Another goal is we do want to make sure that we're reducing the threats to biodiversity, what's leading to its loss. Thirdly, we want to make sure that biodiversity is being used sustainably. And then finally, there's an important component of equity. We want to make sure that the actions under the framework ensure that benefits that accrue from biodiversity are shared fairly and equitably. That's one of the third objectives of the convention, an important one as well.
And so just to jump in here, David, the Global Biodiversity Framework, I mean, effectively, that will be like the Kyoto Protocol, if you will. It's the global commitment we need from all governments that will lay out the pathways for action leading up to 2050. And so what needs to happen in these next 2 weeks?
So there's really four things. So first of all, we need to make sure that we adopt a comprehensive and achievable framework. But when we do that, it must also be coupled with the resources needed to make sure it's implemented. Second of all, the targets in the framework need to clearly address the drivers of biodiversity loss, so overexploitation, pollution. Third of all, we need to make sure that this plan we're implementing safeguards the rights of Indigenous peoples and local communities and recognizes their contributions as stewards of nature, because we know now that for some of our protection questions, setting up protected areas or other forms of protection, the role of Indigenous peoples and local communities is crucial. They're some of the most effective actions in terms of conserving things. And then fourth, I think we really need to make sure that we come up with a strong policy alignment on the imperative to mainstream biodiversity in policies across sectors and in financial decision-making. Mandatory disclosures on nature-related risks and impacts, a strong regulatory landscape that's going to align financial flows and investment towards sustainable investments and away from these environmentally harmful ones.
So there's a lot that needs to happen then. And thank you both for breaking down why now matters, what we need to get behind these next 2 weeks. Coming back then to the Global Biodiversity Framework, you shared that within that framework, there is a call to close the finance gap. Elizabeth, you referred to the Paulson Institute Nature Conservancy report that there's $700 billion estimated dollars that we need a year for conservation and biodiversity. Are there any specific actions mentioned within the framework that can help us get closer to closing that finance gap?
Indeed, the draft Global Biodiversity Framework includes a dedicated call to action. And this is supported by specifically two action targets. One, reducing and repurposing incentives that are harmful to biodiversity. It is also calling for increasing financial resources from international and domestic resources with an intention or ambition to increase funding from all sources to actually at least $200 billion and increasing international flows to developing countries by at least $10 billion per year.
Wow.
And of course, the $200 billion, that also assumes that the $500 billion spent per year on harmful subsidies will be repurposed and redirected. We have learned about aligning and using alignment to shift finance from the recent experience in the climate space. Now, under the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, more than 450 financial institutions representing more than $130 trillion in private capital have announced their commitment to net zero by 2050.
So it's fantastic to hear that there will be a rallying cry to increasing public and private finance flows, but also reducing subsidies. Before we come on to the former in more detail about how we can get the money moving, can we just pause and reflect on the benefits of tackling harmful subsidies? I think that one often gets missed from more detailed discussions. So David, talk us through why is that so important?
One of the findings of this State of Finance for Nature report 2022 was that nature positive or biodiversity positive investments are significantly undermined by the really high level of nature negative expenditures we see right now. So, you know, government expenditure on environmentally harmful subsidies to fisheries, it's estimated that it's around $500 billion to as much as $1 trillion U.S. dollars per year.
Wow.
And the truth is that's 3 to 7 times greater than any nature positive investments. So, I mean, what this tells us is that governments need to focus on reforming and repurposing these biodiversity harmful subsidies. So this kind of alignment, it would provide rapid biodiversity benefits. And the thing about it, too, is that in doing this alignment needs to happen in a just and equitable way, with a focus on making sure that we're meeting the needs of the most vulnerable people in our society. But just like the subsidies that are provided to fossil fuels in the context of climate change, we need to see this happening really rapidly.
We've discussed before that companies and financial institutions, of course, should not just be waiting around for governments to make these biodiversity commitments. There are voluntary commitments that the private sector can make. And indeed, as institutions, it just seems they save those big announcements for these COPs and conferences these days. So actually, these next 12 days or so, we could see some very big announcements of initiatives and commitments coming out of the financial and the broader private sector that, you know, hopefully will turn into action, not just be commitments. So Elizabeth, can you talk us through what you would like to see in terms of commitments and actions from the finance sector in particular?
Financial institutions can already take action. And what more they need to do is, one, engage with investees to influence their strategies and call on their clients to set the science-based targets. Two, we need them to assess, measure, and set targets to manage their impacts on biodiversity, including through the recent principles of responsible banking guidance on biodiversity target setting. Three, calling on them to allocate capital away from harmful activities and direct capital towards actions that are positive for biodiversity through their policies. Four, we'd like them to engage with scientific and technical initiatives to set common measurement approaches. Five, to encourage government ambition in the jurisdiction they operate. And here I give the example of investor signatories to the Finance for Biodiversity Pledge, which did recently in calling for stronger regulation on nature. And six, the support to the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosure, or TNFD, which is currently developing a harmonized reporting and disclosure of nature-related financial risk impacts and dependencies, and getting then both corporate bodies and financial institutions to report. We know for the Task Force on Climate Financial Disclosure, they began voluntary, then they moved to mandatory disclosure. Likewise, TNFD intends to begin voluntary, as a voluntary initiative, with the hope, of course, in future to be called for mandatory. But of course, we are also seeing a push or pressure from the financial institutions, business, corporate bodies, actually calling on negotiators of the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework to make this disclosure mandatory in nature. So that's a welcome move.
And these are really helpful. And we will make sure that we post these 6 recommendations on LinkedIn so we can all get behind them. And typically when we make these calls for action from the finance sector, it's the large financial institutions that we're talking about. And one thing we rarely discuss is the role of smaller regional, local, commercial or corporate banks, banks that lend to farmers, to NGOs, to small and medium-sized businesses. It's possible that the topic of biodiversity and biodiversity loss isn't making its way into these smaller but crucial financial institutions, especially when it comes to the agricultural transition. Are there messages that those banks in particular can hear, David?
So it's really clear that, you know, incentives to farmers and smallholders, they're really instrumental to achieving these practices that are positive for biodiversity. We can illustrate this answer by looking at this paradox of current commodity production models. So we depend on, you know, a whole range of ecological services to eat. So, you know, we need fertilization, we need pollination, we need water service, et cetera, et cetera. But yet at the same time, we're carrying out actions that destroy biomes and take away all these key services that are central to food production. And in fact, agriculture really is the leading driver of global biodiversity loss. And, you know, faced with that situation now, and then faced with the prospects that demand for food and agricultural products, especially animal proteins, are going to increase in the coming years. And so we're looking at that, you know, really hitting the wall here. There's certain regions that are really at the center of this challenge. I mean, I think we can say that the Amazon and Cerrado regions of Brazil, the Chaco regions of Paraguay and Argentina are really quite crucial. And so there's a need that we have to identify how can finance be an impactful leverage point in the industry, particularly in these areas, to move towards sustainability.
That's really interesting. I mean, what support do you think they need?
You know, if farmers and smallholders can get financial help, they can intensify production on existing pasture land or on degraded lands using a whole variety of methods, rotation methods, and then there's no need to carry out further deforestation. You know, the other thing is through the adoption of sustainable business models, additional deforestation and conversion of a lot of that native vegetation can be avoided in its entirety. We can also then increase productivity on the farms. And then, you know, lenders and investors can achieve really in the long run, higher returns on investment for this. And just one more thing to mention is when I was at COP27, I was talking to representatives of the Global Environment Facility and the Green Climate Fund, who were talking about some successful projects in microfinance. I believe BNP Paribas was involved in that. We're looking at specifically in these regions, looking at these small grants. And so that's the sort of thing that I think we need to look at. How can we expand and add on that? Because, you know, a simple loan of $1,000 American can make a huge difference for some of these people. But I think one of the things is to help reduce risk for these banks. And so in that case, you know, additional financing or partnering with some of these, you know, large global institutions would make a difference. But they're ready to make the difference, but they would just need, you know, in some cases, a bit more support so that they can see the benefits, and then need some kind of co-financing, at least in the early stages, so that they can see the business benefits to them for moving in the space.
So, Elizabeth, we heard so much at COP27 about the role that MDBs and DFIs could be playing and aren't at the moment, whether that's coming with more funding or more innovative funding through the role of guarantees. Will COP15 be a chance to move that conversation forward, do you think? Can we see some greater commitment from those institutions and organisations in playing a more catalytic role with their funding?
Let me be positive and say hope so. And I'm saying so, for instance, in terms of setting financial incentives, the public financial sector can really accelerate the deployment of private capital flows by providing support for blended finance toolbox, technical assistance grants, or concessional capital, or the risking mechanisms such as insurance or guarantees. And these methods are particularly needed in the emerging markets. While such tools do exist, they are not currently deployed fast enough at the needed scale or well tailored to the needs of biodiversity and sectoral stakeholders. So a lot to be done there.
Right.
And if I look at G7 and G20 countries are particularly important here as the wealthiest nations who provide the bulk of the official development assistance or ODA. There is considerable urgency at the moment. And if we are to bend the curve of biodiversity loss by 2030, financial institutions do need to act rather immediately and fast. And we are working to step up ambition, provide private voluntary initiatives, and with appropriate incentive setting, together with financial institutions and business, that policymakers can close the financial gap. During the COP itself, for instance, we'll have 2 days dedicated for the discussion among the business community called Business and Biodiversity Day. And we'll have a full day on business and finance. So again, bringing the business and financial institutions into this conversation together with the government negotiators to really be able to play a role in closing that finance gap we are talking about.
Yeah, it's really going to take that collaboration. And you sound very hopeful, Elizabeth, and that gives me hope. So thank you for that. So finally, just as we wrap up here, this is a very difficult question to answer, I'm sure. But what are you hoping will come out of the next 2 weeks? What are your personal hopes and professional hopes?
The outcome we as the world community need is for a consensus to emerge on a strong set of goals for 2050, achievable targets for 2030. And with that, we also want to see an achievable plan for implementation and resource mobilization. We need to see resources to be allocated, redirected in support of positive biodiversity. Our planet is in crisis. And our COP15 is our chance to change that trajectory. And it is my hope that that can be done.
And David, final thoughts?
I mean, it's tough to follow up on what Elizabeth has said. I think the one of the key outcomes we need from COP15 is really the beginning of engagement across society and government and sectors as well, so that as we get this agreement moving, we've mobilized not just government sectors, but we've mobilized business, finance, subnational governments, everybody in this common area, and that mobilization is part of this implementation that we need to move forward on.
Well, Elizabeth and David, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us and really helping us understand what is taking place the next 2 weeks, why it matters, and what we can do to encourage our governments and financial institutions to do. And it goes without saying that we are sending you both our best wishes and hopes for a really successful conference.
Thank you very much. Those wishes are needed.
Indeed, they're most welcome. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that is it from us today. Sadly, I will be heading to Montreal and hope to bring you some of the news from there over the next 12 days. And we will be revisiting the outcomes of the conference in episodes early into 2023, including with Andrew Mitchell, co-founder of the TNFD. In the meantime, we will be posting content every day of COP15 on LinkedIn, and you'll also find a summary of the key points that Elizabeth and David have gone through today. Should that be of help to you, it will be on the GFI LinkedIn page, and I will attempt to also repost it on mine. It is worth a shout out that the State of Finance for Nature report is out from UNEP. They're launched on the 1st of December. You can find that on the UN website. It can also be found on our resources page. You can get there by visiting greenfinanceinstitute.co.uk/GFI Hive. And there you can also sign up for our monthly newsletter, which will bring you news on the conference before we head off for the holidays later in December. Please do drop me a line on LinkedIn if you are in Montreal. I would absolutely love to see you there. But we will be back with another episode very soon. And all that remains for me to say is a big thank you to our partners this COP season, United Nations Environment Programme. See you soon.